What I do today is just share with you the lecture that I gave in Seattle a couple of weeks ago. It's the one that I will give in a number of places over the next few weeks. Obviously, it will vary a little bit each time, but I think it's important to understand exactly where we are now prophetically and what's happening. This was the brochure they sent out, World News and Prophecy Seminar. And the first lecture I gave was titled, "And He Set Ephraim Before Manasseh." It says, "Before the United States, the British Empire was the world's greatest power. How power passed from London to Washington after World War II gives us insight on America's problems today and a warning on how power will pass from the U.S. to the next superpower." And so that's what I want to talk about today. The series of articles I'm just writing for the Good News, starting the last issue, Are America's Superpower Days Numbered? And then the next issue concentrates on Europe, and then the third one is on the Middle East, which I haven't written yet, but I've got to get that written before I go to Turkey next month, because these are the three main areas of prophecy, geopolitics, if you like, when it comes to prophecy. That is the decline of the English-speaking countries, the coming together of the European nations to form the final beast power, and also the problems in the Middle East. I would put the Middle East first, but the reason I chose to put the Middle East last this time is because nothing much was happening in the Middle East when I was starting to write this series. I was asked to do this series. And nothing much was happening, but a lot was happening in terms of our finances and everything. So I did the U.S. and Britain first, and then Europe second, and then the Middle East third. So I'm hoping a war starts or something before I have to do my article on the Middle East. And that will then give me a good introduction. So maybe you can pray about that. I'm just kidding. But it does help if there's some big news, like if Iran claims it's got nuclear weapons or something. That would be a help. It's always good to have a dramatic beginning to an article. Anyway, the article, "Are America's Superpower Days Numbered?" was also inspired somewhat by a very good book I read called Picking Up the Reins, R-E-I-N-S, by Norman Moss, who's a British journalist and historian. And he wrote this book looking at how power passed from the British Empire to the United States in the months after World War II. In fact, in the 2 or 3 years after World War II. And, you know, that ties in with prophecy. Look at Genesis chapter 48. Just have a look here. Because it really makes the Bible come alive when you see that so many things were prophesied to take place and they've been happening. And sometimes when you live in a place that's fairly stable, like where we are, I mean, Lansing is fairly stable. In fact, I was saying to Diane the other day, you know, with all the threats of terrorism going on and economic upheaval, this is probably about the best place in the world to live. I don't mean the United States in general. I wouldn't want to live in New York or Washington, D.C. I mean, look at Washington, D.C. last week, just a little snow, and the whole city closes down for a week. You know, what would happen if they had, you know, something really bad happened to Washington, D.C.? California, of course, I wouldn't want to live there either. But here, I mean, you know, sometimes it might be rather boring, but I'll take boring over some of those other places any day. So there's a lot of advantages to living here, and we should be thankful for those blessings that we have. It's about the safest place in the world to be, I think, where we are. Maybe the UP is safer, but nobody in their right mind would want to live up there. Look at Genesis 48, beginning in verse 15. "And he blessed Joseph and said, 'God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads.'" Now these are the two boys of Joseph, and Jacob, Israel, is saying, "Bless the lads, let my name be named upon them." And it's very important, really, that this is a very important verse, prophetically, because what he's saying, in effect, is that the name of Israel was placed on the two boys of Joseph, not Judah. Judah was another son. Joseph was one son, but Judah was another son. Judah actually was born before Joseph. But the name of Israel was to be placed upon Joseph's boys. Of course, later on, we know historically, we know that the Jews had their own kingdom, Judah, that Israel broke away from Judah. So 10 tribes formed their own nation, which they called Israel. So, you know, any serious student of Bible prophecy or history knows that the Jews and Israel were separate. You know, when I mentioned that in Australia in a seminar, a lady got really upset, an old lady, and walked out with her daughter, and she was a Jew, and she just could not handle the fact that the Jews and Israel were two distinct peoples in the Old Testament. But it's right there, not just prophetically, but historically as well, because, you know, the 10 tribes broke away from the Davidic monarchy and formed their own nation, Israel. But anyway, here, Israel is saying, let my name be named on them and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. It's all very deliberately and in great detail written down because of its significance. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Now it's important for us to realize that, you know, sometimes in the churches of God now, you've got people saying that we've got it all the wrong way around, it's the other way around. Because right now, the United States is the dominant power in the world, has been for the last 60 years. You'd have to be at least 70, Richard Dalton's age, basically, to remember a time when the United States was not the major power in the world. Sorry. But you'd have to be over 70 to remember a time when the United States was not the major power in the world. And, of course, before World War II, it was the British Empire. But the further we get away from that, the more you're going to see people claiming it's the other way around, that the United States is Ephraim and Britain is Manasseh. But if people start to think that, then they're going to falter when it comes to the timeline. They're not going to be able to see clearly the prophetic timeline and to know where we are in terms of Bible prophecy. And confusion arises. And I'll come to that in a few moments. But look at chapter 49 first. Chapter 49 says, Jacob called his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. So this is a prophecy which is, again, very detailed, and it's also a prophecy about the last days. It shows the relevance of Bible prophecy to this time. And you go down to verse 22, and there's a key to understanding prophecy. Now, you know, I brought this up a couple of times in lectures, but since then I've had other ministers say this is a very important point, and I should bring it out every opportunity I've got. Genesis 49, verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. Now, the reason why this is important is because it doesn't mention Ephraim and Manasseh, it mentions Joseph. So in Genesis 49, a prophecy specifically about the last days, it mentions the United States and Britain together, not separately. And you can't really understand the timeline, you can't understand really prophecy and even history without an understanding, without looking at both together. This came up the other night, last Saturday and Sunday night. Diane and I and our daughter Palace watched a series from Showtime on the Tudors. And the Tudors were a dynasty in the 1500s, 1485 to 1603 exactly. And the most significant, or the most, the king that most people would remember for all the wrong reasons, is Henry VIII. You know, Henry had six wives. Now, I hesitate to recommend this series because it's quite bloodthirsty, okay? Henry was really a tyrant, and I think more people lost their heads during his reign than lost their wallets, you know, because he was quite a ruthless king. But the thing that struck me as we were watching this, and I said to Diane, I said, you know, it's amazing when you think about it, that prophetically, if it wasn't for Henry, we would never have had freedom of religion, and we would never have had the United States of America. And yet here he is, clearly bloodthirsty, an absolute tyrant, and yet it's amazing just how sometimes prophecies get fulfilled. But it was Henry that broke away from Rome. It was Henry that legalized the Bible in 1537. Yes, he also cut off a lot of people's heads, and including two wives and umpteen other people that surrounded him. But it's just amazing what a difference he made in a period of time. He reigned for, he reigned for 38 years, that's all. But he made an incredible difference during that time. But again, it's an example of how when you look at the history of both countries, you understand things much more clearly. And because of Henry, and especially his daughter Elizabeth as well, the United States became possible, whereas it wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for them. The title of this lecture or sermon is Thus He Said Ephraim Before Manasseh. And, like I mentioned, a number of people in the churches of God are claiming that we've got things the wrong way round because the United States is clearly the dominant power today and the British Empire has receded into insignificance. It's a dim memory. But let me just run through seven reasons, which I put in my latest article in World News and Prophecy, as to why it doesn't work the other way round and why it isn't the other way round. The understanding we've had going back to Mr. Armstrong, and which many people outside of the churches of God have had, going right back to the 1840s, because this is the first time a book was written on this subject, was I think in 1840, so it's a long period of time, and it's before the churches of God. But during that time, in the 1800s and 1900s, a lot of people believed that Britain and the United States were the descendants of Joseph, and the British Empire was much bigger than the United States, and it was expanding rapidly in Victoria's time, whereas the United States was one country expanding westwards, so people could see the fulfillment of the prophecy. So here are reasons why it's the way that it is, the way we've always understood it. First of all, the British Empire was much bigger than the United States. At its height, in the early decades of the 20th century, the British Empire covered one-third of the world's territory. In 1897, the year of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, it was 11 million square miles. It kept on expanding right up until 1933, when it was 13.9 million. This compares to the U.S., which is 3.65 million square miles. So the British Empire was 13.9 million, the U.S. 3.65 million square miles. Secondly, in terms of population, the British Empire was also bigger. The U.S. today has a population of approximately 310 million. In the last Indian census under British rule, India's population alone was 320 million, added to which there were millions in Africa, the Caribbean, Pacific, Hong Kong, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and elsewhere. Thirdly, the British Empire had a longer innings. It's difficult to say exactly when Britain became the preeminent nation of the world. Some would say it was in 1759 when the British defeated the French in Quebec and the whole eastern seaboard came under the control of the English-speaking power. But certainly by 1815, when Napoleon was defeated, it was clear to everyone that Britain was the undisputed master of the globe. Point number four, the U.S. today has greater firepower than Britain had due to advances in technology, but in terms of relative power, Britain was greater. This was acknowledged in 1947 when Washington first came to realize it was taking over from London as the world's policeman. I want to quote to you here. Let's have a look here. Without any knowledge of the biblical significance of the moment, Dean Acheson, who was then Undersecretary at the U.S. Department of State, said that Britain was so weakened financially that there were now only two great powers in the world. Not since Rome and Carthage, he said, had there been such a polarization of power, and it was between democracy and dictatorship. In other words, in 1947, when America took over from Britain, because that's the year all this came to fulfillment, already the Soviet Union was a major rival. Britain had had a 100-year period from 1815 to World War I without any rival. So in relative terms, it was more powerful. But Dean Acheson realized that in 1947 when the U.S. was effectively taking over from Britain as the number one power. Point number five, the political nature of the empire was very different to the United States. The U.S. is a federation, one country of 50 states, which are all very similar to each other. The British Empire and Commonwealth was truly a multitude of nations, each one different from the other, each with its own government. The only connection between them was and remains the crown. Queen Elizabeth remains head of the Commonwealth, a successor organization to the empire. Then point number six, investment. It was recently announced that London is once again the world's leading financial center. For over two centuries, it held that role before losing it to New York after World War II. The two-volume definitive work on British economic power is titled British Imperialism by P.J. Kane and A.G. Hopkins, and it shows it's absolutely staggering how great was London's economic power. The British not only developed all the nations of their empire, they were also the greatest investors and developers of the USA, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, the Chinese Empire, the Ottoman Empires in the 19th and well into the 20th centuries. It was a London bank, for example, that financed the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. Then point number seven, often there's a great deal in a biblical name, whereas Ephraim, which means fruitful, could apply to either Britain or the United States. Manasseh, which means causing to forget or forgetful, aptly describes the United States. Americans have often been described as the most forgetful nation on earth, rapidly forgetting and forgiving former enemies and routinely failing to learn the lessons of history. Finally, it should also be pointed out that it simply doesn't work the other way around. If the U.S. is Ephraim, the multitude of nations, Britain could hardly be described as the great single nation that was also prophesied. Without its empire, Britain is no longer a great power. So I just wanted to get that out of the way quickly in case you don't see my article in World News and Prophecy. But it's important to understand there is a sequence here, and you'll see it clearly. Look at Daniel chapter 2, for example. Daniel chapter 2. When you see the timeline, it helps you understand where we are prophetically right now. Because we're going through a period of great change. You know, after World War II, look at Daniel 2. While you turn there, I'll explain this. But, you know, before the end of World War II, Franklin Roosevelt told Winston Churchill that after World War II, he wanted all American troops out of Europe within 2 years. They're still there, and it's been 65 years. As far as Roosevelt was concerned, after World War II, everything was going to go back to the way it had been before World War II. The British Empire would still exist. America was quite happy to let Britain be the policeman of the world, which Britain had been for 200 years. So Roosevelt told Churchill that, we'll pull our troops out and then you're on your own, basically. But it didn't quite go that way. It didn't go as smoothly as that because by January of 1947, less than 2 years after the end of World War II, Britain was in deep financial trouble. Nobody knew how serious it was. And then the British had the most severe winter they'd ever had. And this only made their financial problems even worse. Not only were they ruling a quarter of the world and having to foot the bill, but they also had problems in India. They had problems in Palestine between the Jews and the Arabs, in India between the Hindus and the Muslims. And then they were helping fight the communists in Greece. Greece was not a part of the British Empire, and finally the British decided there was no luck, that they just couldn't do it anymore. They could not possibly help Greece as well as do everything else. So they sent a message to Washington saying that in a few weeks' time we're pulling out of Greece. If you want to help them, go ahead. And that message was received on February 21st in 1947. And let me read to you here what the account is in the book Picking Up the Reins. For two centuries, Britain had been the dominant power in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now it seemed to be surrendering that role in two key countries. The American view of this, when the telegram was received asking America to help, the American view was put in grandiloquent terms by Joseph M. Jones, who was in the State Department at the time. Reading the messages, it was realized, and I quote, that Great Britain had, within the hour, handed the job of world leadership with all its burdens and all its glory to the United States. The date was February 21st, 1947, the day the United States effectively replaced Great Britain as the world's global superpower. Now, again, all this may seem like ancient history, but the fact is it ties in with what is happening to us right now in the United States. And that's the reason why I'm giving this lecture. Look at Daniel 2 and verse 21. Remember, Daniel 2 is a major prophetic chapter where Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and none of the magicians, the Chaldeans, could interpret the dream. He went ballistic, literally, and said he would kill everybody until somebody could tell him what his dream was. And he couldn't even remember himself. But if you remember, God then revealed it all to Daniel. And Daniel said in verse 20, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his." And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. You know, God is behind the rise and fall of nations. And Daniel understood this. Daniel, remember, was brought up in Judah, and then Judah was conquered by Babylon. The Babylonians took the Jews, especially the nobility, which Daniel was, and he spent the next 70 years in Babylon. But before Babylon, before he died, Babylon fell to Persia. God had revealed to him in this chapter, chapter 2, and also in chapter 7, that Persia would replace Babylon. And God also revealed to him that Greece would then replace Persia. And in time, Rome would replace Greece. So Daniel understood that all these different empires were going to come along. Now, you know, because we only live 70 years, and because we've lived, or you have anyway, not me so much, but, you know, because you've grown up in the United States and lived in the United States, and the U.S. has been the world's dominant power, it's hard to imagine a time when that might not be so. But Bible prophecy shows again just how nations rise and fall. And it's all been decided, basically. God is the one who's behind the rise and fall of nations. And when you look at Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, you see that quite clearly. We see in Revelation chapter 17 that it is prophesied that 10 kings or world leaders are going to come together to form the final resurrected beast power before Christ returns in Revelation 17 and verse 12. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. So clearly that is right at the end. So here is another superpower that rises prior to Christ's return. So, you know, where do we fit in all of this? Well, when you read the book Picking Up the Reins, it helps you to understand, again, exactly what happened. When you look at what happened to Britain, you can see clearly that we are going through that same phase now. You know, we are, if you like, the equivalent would be we are in 1946. Because at the end of World War II, Britain had been fighting two world wars and was broke. And, you know, we've been fighting conflicts all over the place, especially Afghanistan and Iraq. And guess what? We're broke. I mean, absolutely broke. The difference between us and Britain was back then in the 1940s, nations did not have the option of printing more money. Today, the U.S. is printing more and more money just to keep afloat. But we are well and truly broke. I mean, it's a very serious problem, this. And, you know, I get the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and both papers every single day. There's something on this, the fact that we are broke as a nation and heavily in debt. In fact, we've got more debt than any other nation in history has ever had. Paul Kennedy, who teaches at Yale, wrote a book in 1987 called The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And he looked back at the last 500 years, and he looked at each of the nations that became the number one country. In the 1500s, it was Spain. The 1700s, the French. 1800s, the British. And towards the end of the 1900s, the United States. But when he looked back at each of the great powers, he found that each one fell for exactly the same two reasons. One was debt. The country went broke. And basically, each country in turn had to borrow money from other countries just to fight its wars. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're borrowing money all the time. In fact, the Financial Times headline a few days ago was, basically panic had set in because the Chinese are no longer buying U.S. Treasury bonds. And everybody's wondering, is this going to be permanent? Are they going to stop buying U.S. Treasury bonds? Because that means we won't be able to borrow anymore. And earlier this week, the Japanese stepped in and bought U.S. Treasury bonds just to keep us afloat. But it's a serious problem. And it's getting, it's becoming more and more serious as time goes on. So borrowing money from other nations is one of the two reasons why nations fall from their number one position, from preeminence. This is what happened to Britain after World War II. It's what happened to France before the British. It's what happened to the Spanish before the French. And it's happening to us as well. And secondly, the second reason nations come down from their top position is what they call imperial overstretch, which is where there's not enough troops to fight all the wars. And we've got that situation too. We don't have enough troops to be able to handle all the problems that confront us around the world. And this was certainly true of Britain in the period 1945 to 1947 at the end of World War II. And, the British, when they sent that telegram to Washington in 1947, they weren't thinking this is the end of the British Empire. They just thought, we can't handle Greece. We're broke. We haven't got the money. So they said to Washington, if you want to save Greece from communism, it's up to you. But really looking back, that was the turning point. Because after that, it was one problem after another, and the finances unraveled. And within 10 years, the British Empire was gone. And it was because the finances unraveled. And that's the same problem that we've got today. Look at Genesis chapter 49, because this helps us understand something too. After one of my articles, the one I wrote for World News and Prophecy, somebody wrote and said that, yes, we've got it the right way round, that the British Empire was Ephraim, the United States was Manasseh. But he said that where he would disagree is that Manasseh's greatest days are still ahead. That was what he wrote. So he felt like America was still in its rise to greatness. And I disagree with that. Not because I want to. I'd like to think that, that was the case, that we will recover from the situation that we're in. And maybe we will. I mean, when in 1979, when Britain was just about on its knees, Margaret Thatcher came to power and turned everything around. And it's possible that could happen again, here. It'd be nice to think it would. I don't think so, because when you look at the timeline, you can see prophetically certain things. Genesis 49, for example. Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." We've always believed, we've always taught that Reuben's descendants today are France. We used to have literature on this. I don't know if we have any literature on that now. Reuben was the firstborn, and France was the first Israelite nation to achieve that number one position under Louis XIV in the early 1700s. And in fact, I tried to get a book recently on Louis XIV from the library system here in Lansing because I wanted to put something in an article. The only book they had was on all his relationships with different women. That was all. And that's a polite way of putting it, by the way. But it's interesting because the French have always had a bad track record in that area. And it's interesting what it says, the next verse, "Unstable as water you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." So, you know, the French have always had that reputation and still do have that reputation, in fact, as well. And, this was a reason why the French, have not been able to excel because, they are as unstable as water as a country. But what is interesting here to me is you look at this prophecy. Reuben, France, was the one that was the firstborn and was to get the glory first. And then you look across the page at Genesis 48, Ephraim, the multitude of nations, was second. And then the great single nation, Manasseh, was third. And, so each one in turn, basically, just as it says in Daniel 2:21, God raises up kings and removes kings. So one nation rises to preeminence for a while, and then it comes down. And it happened to the French in 1759 during the French and Indian Wars. The French lost their part of North America. And their final defeat really came when Napoleon was defeated in 1815. But that was France then out of the picture. France became a second-rate power. And Britain was then the dominant power, the multitude of nations. Then 100 years later, after the two world wars, the United States became the dominant power. So each one in turn. And, now we know that from prophecy in Revelation 17, you still got that final resurrection of the beast power to come. And, I think we're going through this transition at this present time. I mean, some of the newspaper articles right now are interesting. In the Wall Street Journal, for example, deficit balloons into national security threat. You get an article like this almost every day now. But the deficit balloons into national security threat. The U.S. government this year will borrow one of every $3 it spends, with many of those funds coming from foreign countries. That weakens America's standing and its freedom to act. It strengthens China and other world powers. It puts long-term defense spending at risk. Undermines the power of the American system as a model for developing countries. And reduces the aura of power that has been a great intangible asset for presidents for more than a century. So quite a serious article there, and that's the Wall Street Journal. This year, thanks in some measure to continuing high costs from wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. will spend a once unthinkable $688 billion on defense. Before September the 11th, by contrast, the figure was closer to $300 billion. So, you see the financial situation we're getting ourselves into as a nation. The New York Times had an article. The title was, "Huge Deficits May Alter U.S. Politics and Global Power." This was February the 2nd. It says, in a federal budget filled with mind-boggling statistics, two numbers stand out as particularly stunning for the way they may change American politics and American power. The first is the projected deficit in the coming year, nearly 11% of the country's entire economic output. That is not unprecedented. During the Civil War and World War I and II, that happened as well. But it says... let's have a look here. I'll just read a little bit further down. For Mr. Obama and his successors, the effect of those projections is clear. Unless miraculous growth or miraculous political compromises create some unforeseen change over the next decade, there is virtually no room for new domestic initiatives because we don't have the money. Beyond that lies the possibility that the United States could begin to suffer the same disease that's afflicted other nations recently, as debt grew more rapidly than income. In Japan, that country's influence around the world eroded. Or as Mr. Obama's chief economic advisor, Lawrence H. Summers, used to ask before he entered government a year ago, how long can the world's biggest borrower remain the world's biggest power? And that's a good question. How long can we remain the number one power if we are the world's biggest borrower? The Chinese leadership, which is lending much of the money to finance the American government spending, this was written 2 weeks ago, that's changed in that 2 weeks, and which asked pointed questions about Mr. Obama's budget when members visited Washington last summer, says it thinks the long-term answer to Mr. Summers' question is self-evident. America will not continue as the number one power. The Europeans will also tell you that this is a big worry about the next decade. So, again, an interesting article in the New York Times. Now, what is interesting also is this, just to finish up here, Revelation 17 and verse 12 talks about this resurrected Roman Empire at the time of the end. And, you know, there's always been a problem. The European Union is 27 countries, but the final beast power is 10. How do we get from 27 to 10? And I think we might be seeing a hint of that now. I'm not saying it's going to happen in the next few weeks, but we're certainly seeing a hint of it. Because a couple of weeks ago, it turned out that Greece has been cooking the books. You know, in the European Union, any country that uses the euro cannot overspend by more than 3%. So whatever their gross national product is, they can only borrow 3% more. Or overspend by 3%, that's all. But Greece, it turned out, was overspending by 13% and just hiding the figures. And now, lest you think the Greeks must be terribly irresponsible, realize we're overspending by 11%, and a lot of people expect it's going to be higher. So, you know, we're in the same situation, or potentially the same situation as Greece is in. But because Greece was overspending, the very existence of the euro was being threatened. And Greece was not the only country that was overspending. It turns out that there's five countries that are causing problems. There are 16 nations in the eurozone, 27 countries in the European Union. 16 of them use the one currency, the euro. Five of those countries are in trouble. Those countries are known as the pigs. Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. It's easy to remember because just remember pigs, but two eyes. They even call themselves the pigs. So they seem to be proud of the fact that they are the pigs. And, you know, they are causing some major problems. And this is the reason the euro's come down in value quite a bit the last few weeks. But what is interesting is that there is a lot of speculation that, you know, Germany is really upset with these countries. And Stratfor, which is a U.S. intelligence service based in, I think it's based in San Antonio, with connections to the military and everything else, Stratfor claimed last week in an article that the country that's going to benefit the most from this crisis is Germany, because Germany is the country that's going to end up bailing them all out. Germany is going to have to discipline them all, basically. But there was even a suggestion in this article that Germany may kick those five countries out of the eurozone, which would bring it down from 16 to 11. And who knows, by that time there may be one other that's a problem. You see how easily we could get 10? And, you know, the article from Stratfor even brings out, it says, you know, when the Roman Republic was threatened by Hannibal, remember Hannibal across the Alps with his elephants? The Roman Constitution allowed for a dictator, a temporary dictator. So when Rome was threatened by Hannibal, Rome gave power to a dictator. And their suggestion in Stratfor was the same thing could happen in Europe, that the other countries may just give supreme power to Germany to sort the mess out. It said not a dictator as such, but Germany, the one nation. They would give their power to Germany to sort it all out. This was in Stratfor last week, and again, that's an American intelligence service, which is very highly respected. And this was their summation of the situation, that only Germany could sort this out, and this is what might happen in order to save Europe. And that would tie in very much with Bible prophecy. But, you know, the point of my lecture is we're going through a very interesting period, and it's a period of transition. In 1947, excuse me, I got to quit smoking. It's one thing I've never done, you know. I've never even had one cigarette in my whole life. So, anyway, in 1947, when Britain asked the United States for help, the British did not realize the significance. And only a couple of people did in Washington. As I mentioned, I quoted that one guy who said, Britain has just handed all the power to America. But most people did not understand the significance at the time. And, we, looking back, may see this year as a very significant year in American history, too. Most people don't get the significance. Some people do. You've got people like this, and you've got Lawrence Summers, for example, who realized that as the biggest borrower, we cannot possibly continue as the world's biggest power. So times are changing. And, we're living through a very significant period. And Bible prophecy showed, France was number one for a while, Britain was number one, and then the U.S. number one, and we've still got this other power that's going to rise up and be number one for a very brief period prior to Christ's return. But, when you look at it that way, you see God's hand behind everything, and it's actually very encouraging because it makes you realize just how close we could be to the final fulfillment of the end time prophecies and the establishment of the kingdom of God. And, that's the really exciting thing, to realize that, that is the goal that we're looking towards, and the focus of our attention over the years has been the kingdom of God. And we could certainly be closer than we perhaps realize.